names with our calendar that we are, everybody's now on board. I'll ask the marshal to introduce the panel, please.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Johnson, Judge Hooten, the Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And good morning, everyone, and sorry for the delay. We can't, I guess, blame it on the luck of the Irish today. Judge Hooten, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can, but don't we need Miss Avery?
She's here. At least I see her. Can you hear us?
Is she here?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. Very good. I didn't see you. Thank you.
Thank you.
And we have one oral matter on the court's calendar and four non-oral matters. This first matter is A21586 in the matter of the civil commitment of Charles Randall Ashman. And we have three counsel, and perhaps I'll ask counsel, is it Ms. Elaski on behalf of Hennepin County? It looks like your response largely supports, with one perhaps narrow exception in terms of the remand instruction, Ms. Avery's client's position. Were you intending to make argument today or simply be available for questions if we have them?
Correct, Your Honor. I was not intending to argue, just if you had questions.
Okay. Well, we appreciate that, and we may indeed have those for you as well. We ask then counsel for the remaining counsel, you'll have the usual 15 minutes. Hopefully you can see the clock in the corner. As long as we have no troubles like we did starting out today, everything should be fine. But the marshal knows that if at any time we lose you, the marshal will stop the clock. And so an appellant, of course, will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. We do ask that you identify yourself, your name for the record. And I'll just note also for all other participants that the recording of this proceeding is prohibited by judicial branch rules, but you are allowed to review the online recording, which will be available on the judicial branch's website within 24 hours. So with that being said, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor's counsel. My name is Jill Avery, and may it please the court, I'm the attorney with Templeman Law, and we represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Charles Ashman. The issue here today is whether the commitment appeal panel erred when they declined to rehear and reconsider Mr. Ashman's transfer revocation appeal. The commitment appeal panel did err because they are authorized and required by statute, by case law, as well as by due process considerations to review a revocation appeal. We therefore ask this court to remand Mr. Ashman's revocation appeal back to the commitment appeal panel for a new proceeding to rehear and reconsider his revocation and for the other requested relief.
Didn't they consider his new petition for a transfer?
They did consider his petition for a new transfer, and that was denied, and he did not appeal that.
All right. Were the factors involved in that decision also the same factors that would be utilized in determining if you are correct that they had authority to determine if the review board's recommendation was correct on the revocation?
Not at all. And that's one of the arguments that the commissioner made. In the Doherty case, they only reviewed the new transfer criteria because that petition was only about a new transfer. But under the statutory language, there's two reduction in custodies we're talking about. One is a provisional discharge, and the other one is a transfer. And the transfer is to CPS. That is the only facility that's available to transfer to. Both of these are considered reductions of custody. They move them out of the institutional prison-like setting to CPS, which is a dormitory-like setting, or else into the community under a provisional discharge. For a provisional discharge, for a new provisional discharge, the statutory requirement is a determination of whether the person is capable of making an acceptable adjustment to open society. That is the overarching question in a provisional discharge, and that is subdivision 253D.30. When they make that overall determination, they consider two factors, and one of them involves the treatment needs and the mental status of the person. And the second one is whether the provisional discharge plan provides safety to the public and allows the person to be successfully adjust to open society. Now, for a provisional discharge revocation, the review is simply about the circumstances of the revocation. And a person can be revoked if he violates the provisional discharge plan or is dangerous. But the statutory language is simply that the panel reviews the circumstances of the revocation and decides whether or not to uphold that revocation.
Ms. Avery, can I just interrupt you a moment? And you're right now talking about point 30, if I understand 253D point 3, because that's what provision the Doherty Court was looking at, correct? Would you agree that that the point 27, which defines reduction in custody, while it references revocation of provisional discharge, does not reference, if I understand that definition correctly, revocation of a transfer, which I understand is the respondent's, or at least I assume, actually, I should say, I don't know that I saw that directly in respondent's brief. And yet you started out by saying the CAP was required. Can you point me to a particular provision why you say it was required as well as authorized? And do you see a distinction between statutory authorization and requirement? In other words, can one be authorized but not required, right, or does one follow from the other?
Right. Well, in the case of these statutes, they stemmed out of were all combined in the mentally ill and dangerous statutes to start. And as they branched off, certain things didn't get transferred or lined up exactly in the statutes. For example, under 253B.18, where the SRB has the authority, they were not authorized to even review a transfer revocation. And that is because the right to revoke a transfer wasn't added to the statutes until 2016, I believe. And there is an error in the statutes under 253B where they didn't go back and add that authorization even to the special review board. But as we discussed in the briefs and at the court, in the court of the panel with the commitment appeal panel, the intent of the statutes is that they would be treated the same. And I think the parties agreed that Doherty, it is a provisional discharge case, but they are, the process is the same and it should be the same. And the statutes should reflect that. There is error in the statutes because as they split off from the mentally ill and dangerous, certain things did get left off. So they don't talk about the revocation of a transfer like they do a revocation of a provisional discharge, but they should be considered the same. They are the same reduction in custody.
But thank you, Ms. Avery. Mm-hmm. Isn't it true though that we can't presume error when we're interpreting statute? In fact, we presume the legislature knew what they were doing,
right,
unless and until mm-hmm. perhaps there's some ambiguity or perhaps some absurd right. results. Right. So what specifically would you direct us to in these three statutes? And I say three, seems to me we're looking at 0.29, 0.28, and 0.27 in reverse order to understand the issue that the parties right. have raised. Am I correct? Well, and where would you direct us?
Well, the transfer, if you look at the requirements, the statute for a new transfer, that is 253D.29 subdivision 1A. And that overarching requirement is that to be granted a new transfer, they have to determine whether a transfer is appropriate. And they do consider the requirements under 1B, the five requirements, which have to do with treatment and mental health status and also security requirements. They do consider that, but the new transfer overarching question is whether a new transfer is appropriate, considering all those things. Now in the transfer revocation, the overarching question is not whether that a transfer is appropriate, and they never call in subdivision 1A. What they say is the determination is whether or not to uphold the revocation after reviewing the circumstances of the revocation. And they do ask them to consider the factors in 1B. But if you look at the factors in under the transfer, the 1B, there are five of them. And for example, 1A has, the first one, number one, has only to do with clinical progress and treatment needs. And the last one has only to do with public safety. Certain ones of them have to do somewhat with transfer, with treatment and security needs. For example, the second one is the need for security to accomplish treatment. So it's kind of a combined factor. For example, in Mr. Ashman's case, one of the reasons he was revoked is he had a broken GPS. They were concerned about his, the reason given was security. So in that case, they are going to review the circumstances of the revocation that he had a broken GPS, and they're going to consider this, the factors, but they wouldn't necessarily consider a factor about treatment when he has a broken GPS. They may consider the public safety, and they may consider whether he can get, he has a security to accomplish treatment if he's broken his GPS, but they wouldn't necessarily consider his mental status or his clinical progress. That wouldn't be appropriate. But because there's five of them, and some of them do have strictly to do with security, some have strictly to do with treatment, and some are a little bit combined, the statute doesn't go into details. I do want to point out under the new transfer requirement, they use the word that they must consider all five. They do not use that word in the revocation statute, and they do not require the person to show that he has that overarching question of 1A, that transfer is appropriate. So there are two different aspects of looking at those factors, whether it's appropriate or whether the revocation should be upheld. And so the factors are entirely different, whether it's a new petition versus a revocation. And I think that was demonstrated in the Bushway case. In that case, which is the first and only real revocation appeal.
But could I ask you this? What factor, if we remanded this back, if we said, yes, you're right, they should, they had the authority to do it, what factor would they consider that they didn't consider already as part of the, as part of their analysis of the petition for transfer?
Well, they would need to look at each of the reasons that were given for the revocation, and then they would need to apply that to the applicable factors, which makes sense. For example, the one I gave you about the GPS, they would be looking at his security, the security factors. He also was given some reasons that he was revoked because of treatment needs. Then they would look at the factors that had to do with the treatment needs. But it wouldn't make sense to look at whether there's public safety when they're only talking about that maybe he missed treatment or things like that. So they would have to look at the applicant, not that they wouldn't consider them, but they may look at them and say, this doesn't apply. They would pick out the factors that make sense relative to that revocation. And that's the similar in the provisional discharge revocation, in that there's two reasons for revoking somebody, whether they violated their provisional discharge plan, and the other one is if they were dangerous. And they don't ask them to go back and review the provisional discharge to see whether they are capable of making an open, acceptable adjustment to open society, or whether they have treatment needs and mental status support that. They just look at the reasons for revocation. I do want to touch briefly on the...
I'm sorry, Ms. Avery, I'm sorry. I'm unclear on one thing, and that is... So if the SRB is considering, if the SRB is reviewing the revocation of transfer to CPS, in subdivision 3E, the SRB is instructed to consider the factors in subdivision 1B. Are those the only factors that the SRB considers, or does the SRB also consider the revocation factors that the executive director was required to consider that are listed in subdivision 3A? Does that question make sense?
Are we talking about provisional discharge or?
Transfer.
Transfer, okay.
So I'm looking at 29.
29, okay.
Section, yeah. But and to reiterate, paragraph E, 3E, refers the SRB to the factors in subdivision 1B, but of course, paragraph 3A provides the executive director with some factors concerning revocation.
Right, the 3A is the reasons that they can revoke somebody. And those are the factors.
They being the executive director.
Right, exactly. And then they would take that reason, they have to give
us- using they for different people, I think.
I'm sorry.
Different people in groups.
Yes, so the SRB and the Judicial Appeal Panel both would look at the circumstances that they were revoked and then apply the fact and look at the factors of the transfer as well relative to that revocation reason.
What factors? Which factors?
Under subdivision 1B.
And only 1B? In other words, so the SRB and the panel do not look at the factors listed in subdivision 3A?
They look at the reason for revocation. So they consider the reason for revocation, which are the factors under 3, and then they consider the reason, the transfer factors, when they review the revocation.
But it seems sort of odd to me that if the SRB is reviewing the executive director's revocation decision, and if the executive director is required to consider the factors in sub 3A, it seems odd to me that the SRB would not also be required to consider the factors in sub 3A.
Oh, I think they do. They are considering the
reason. Who's they?
SRB and Judicial Appeal Panel would both do that.
So they would consider, okay, so to answer my question, the SRB and the appeal panel, assuming that they get there, would consider the factors in 3A and the factors in 1B.
Right. So that's the reason, the under 3A1 and 2, that is the reasons that the executive director can do a revocation. So for example, in Mr. Ashman's case, one was that he had a broken GPS. And the reason being that remaining in a non-secure setting wouldn't provide a reasonable degree of safety to the committed person. So that is that's the revocation reason, and they would have to consider that. Then they also look at the transfer factors, whether they're applicable. They'd have to look at whether it provides a reasonable degree of safety to the public for the person to have a broken GPS.
So I'm sorry I interrupted you before. You wanted to use your last 3 or 4 minutes on a different topic. I appreciate that clarification.
I wanted to speak briefly about the Doherty case, and it's not about revocation. So Mr. Doherty never petitioned for a revocation appeal. He was prohibited then from appealing that to the SRB or the Judicial Appeal Panel.
Well, he petitioned for restructuring. And that's
key here, in that once he did not petition for a revocation, he was revoked after the 7 days. There is no provisional discharge plan to reconsider. The only petition that could go forward was the new transfer petition. And that's exactly what happened in the Doherty case. And that's why they only considered the new factors of a new transfer, is because that's all that was on the plate, even to the SRB. They could not consider a revocation, and they did not. And that's, the holding was correct, in that they reviewed a new provisional discharge, I should say. And the Bushway case, they could not consider a new transfer because he didn't petition for it. All they were able to consider was the revocation factors. Thank you. I think my time is up.
Thank you, Ms. Avery. And of course, you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal. I'm going to elect discretion, since Ms. Alasky's here on behalf of Hennepin County, to ask her one question before I turn it over to Mr. Winter. And Ms. Alasky, if I read your brief correctly, you're largely in agreement with, I think, what you just heard, the summary of Ms. Avery, but for the issue of remand instruction, I think it's your position, your client's position, that if remanded, there would be discretion in the cap as to whether to reopen the hearing or to rely on the evidence received. Now, does that mean you agree, well, number one, with Ms. Avery, that to consider revocation, the cap needed to consider both subdivisions 1 and 3 of 29, and that there was evidence related to all the factors of both 1 and 3, such the cap could simply make some additional findings without needing to have any more evidence?
Correct. I believe that the cap had sufficient evidence that they could make findings sufficient to, since they did make findings regarding the new transfer, they went through all of the factors under subdivision 1A, the five factors. However, the revocation, Hennepin County believes that they should remand, that we're hoping that you remand to the cap, and that they provide findings sufficient to support the revocation under 3A, those two factors. And we don't believe that they need to reopen the hearing. There was testimony, there was evidence presented, there was sufficient time and for the Mr. Ashman to present that evidence, and he did present that evidence. So it's just a matter of keeping in line with the statutory criteria that the CAP panel can look at the revocation of, the revocation.
Can I just follow up then? Mm-hmm. 3A1, for instance, remaining in a non-secure setting will not provide a reasonable degree of safety to the committed person or others. My recollection reviewing the order, and I've looked at it a couple times, it seems like that issue, the CAP did make findings, did they not?
Well, I think the findings that they made were consistent with, as Ms. Avery was arguing, subdivision 1A, but they didn't specifically, in the order, they specifically said that they cannot look at the revocation because of Doherty. And our position is that Doherty is inaccurate for this particular type of case, and that the CAP can actually issue findings regarding the revocation. And so since the order doesn't specifically state that they can issue findings, I think that is what the crux is. But at the same time, I don't believe that the outcome would be any different if it were to be remanded, but simply that the CAP actually makes the findings that they can look at a revocation of a transfer.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Lasky. Do either judge have a question for Ms. Lasky before I turn it over to Mr. Winter?
I just want to ask one question. Sure. Ms. Lasky, what factor do you think that CAP did not consider that it should have relative to the revocation?
It
seems like there's a lot of overlap, right? And the same factors would apply for both. Well, what factor is there here that's missing that they need to make specific findings on?
I think they just have to delineate that they can make the findings for a revocation, because in the CAP order, it states that they cannot look at the revocation, that they can only look at the petition for new transfer. And so I think I do believe, just as you alluded to, that the findings would be very similar. It would pretty much be the same, but for the fact that the CAP stated that they could not make findings regarding revocation, but that they could only consider the petition for new transfer.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, so all they have to say is, well, we have the same findings, but this is with reference to revocation. Do we really need to remand for that?
Well, just to acknowledge, and I think for future cases, just to acknowledge that the CAP actually can
look at
revocation.
I understand that. But assuming we say yes, Ms. Avery and Ms. Alesky, you're correct on the law, is there a need for a remand here if the findings are otherwise applicable to both revocation and the denial of a petition for transfer? Because there's so much overlap here.
There is quite a bit of overlap. I think as long as my concern is just for future cases and for clarity of future cases, when the CAP has the actually has the authority to look at revocation appeals, I think that is in terms of whether or not this particular case needs to be remanded for that issue, I don't necessarily think that it does have to be remanded for them to, they're not correcting anything. They would just be stating that, yes, the CAP can actually look at revocations of transfer of provisional discharge. You know, they don't have to deal with provisional discharge, but just that they do have that authority. So I guess I don't believe necessarily that it has to be remanded for them just to issue that. I think it would just clean up the case a little bit more if they actually acknowledged that at this time that they do have the authority to look at revocations.
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Ms. Alasky. And respondent, you may now have, and we'll add the full 15 minutes. I'll ask the marshal to turn it back since I cut into your time. We didn't intend to do that. Very good. You may proceed.
Thank you, Judge Sleater. My name is Aaron Winter. I'm an assistant attorney general appearing for argument today on behalf of the commissioner. And my goal in my discussion here, especially in light of the court's questions for Ms. Avery and Ms. Alasky, is just to outline why the statutory process or the conception of the process that Mr. Ashman is expressing doesn't make sense in terms of it doesn't have a textual basis in the statute. And second, it doesn't make sense in the sense that it would create sort of practical problems and practical absurdities. So with respect to, well, and my final comment on that sort of intro is I'm concerned that the revocation versus new transfer process as it relates to 0.27, 0.28, and 0.29 has begun to seem like there's quite a high level of complexity to it. And in the commissioner's view, there really isn't. And so just to start with the textual basis for...
Can I just stop you right there? Because I mean, I don't know how you could even consider a petition for a transfer without also at the same time considering that this person had at least a provisional discharge to a less restrictive setting, and it didn't work out. I mean, wouldn't that go into the analysis? I don't know how you divide these two issues.
I think that's exactly right.
Simultaneously, like this.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think that's exactly correct, and I think that if we were to reach sort of thinking about what the rationale of the legislature may have been in setting forth the process for reviewing a transfer revocation as opposed to a new transfer and the extent to which there's any difference between those two things, that is a basis that makes sense for there not being any difference between those two things in a statutory sense or in a practical sense. And the reason that we know as a textual matter that there isn't a difference between those two things is to look at subdivision 3 and to address questions from Judge Johnson also as it relates to the difference, if any, between the factors that the executive director considers in revoking originally as opposed to the factors that the SRB or the CAP considers in making a decision about whether to retransfer essentially. So subdivision 3A, it is only directed to the executive director, and those factors govern whether the executive director may exercise her power to revoke. The problem for Mr. Ashman's position comes when we get to E. E does not mention that the SRB or CAP will engage in consideration that has anything to do with reviewing whether the executive director appropriately exercise revocation discretion within the meaning of subdivision 3A, 1, and 2.
Well, let's talk about 3E then. Why is there then the language that the SRB can then relay its recommendation to the CAP panel? Why would that be there? Why would the CAP panel need that information if they're not considering whether the revocation was appropriate or not?
Yeah, so that's a question, as I understand it, essentially about whether the commissioner agrees with Doherty. And I think here's what I would say. At the CAP level, Doherty was and is the most applicable authority for the question that was presented. And we feel like the CAP was bound to apply that unpublished, though it may be. In light of Mr. Ashman's brief and then also Hennepin County's position, the commissioner really doesn't have a problem with it if this court were inclined to reconsider Doherty and say that the CAP does have the ability, whether in the provisional discharge context or in the transfer context, to consider revocation or to consider a challenge to the fact of a revocation. I want to be really clear when I say that, because while I think that that would make it error in the sense that they misread Doherty, but just, I guess, in retrospect, if the court were to reconsider Doherty, it would be incorrect for the CAP to say we can't review a transfer revocation. I want to be really clear that statutorily, whether you're reviewing someone who wants to go back to CPS and because they were there previously and then they got revoked, or whether you're reviewing whether someone should be transferred who's never been to CPS, the process that the statute outlines is exactly the same. There's no difference. And
Mr. Winter, can I just follow up with that? How are you saying, I guess I'm looking at 29 and subdivision 3E, any committed person aggrieved by a transfer revocation decision may petition the special review board. So would not Mr. Ashman have had the option to solely raise, because he was aggrieved by the revocation decision, and therefore the special review board would solely be considering the revocation and the factors related to that, and hence that would have gone to the CAP to consider whether the special review board's decision they agree with or would have the revocation was improper.
I agree with you that he would have had the option to file a petition that said, I am not asking for a quote unquote new transfer. I am asking only for review of the revocation decision. And that's where it sort of relates to that part of the Doherty decision that we've been talking about. But the point that I want to emphasize after that is what the CAP, or what the SRB and then the CAP, are directed to do as a result of that decision is not different. What they are directed to do in either event is to consider the factors in subdivision 1 paragraph B, and not some kind of review of the factors in subdivision 3 paragraph A that the executive director applies.
Why would the SRB, I'm asking you why you make that statement. Why would the SRB and the CAP not review the factors in 3A, since those are the factors that guided the executive director in making the decision that's under review?
It's because that's two reasons, really. It's because that's the explicit textual directive in subdivision 3E of point 29. That's the first reason. The second reason is that there, in the discussion above that in point 29 subdivision 1, that does not, those factors do not limit themselves, or the language in there does not limit it to application only in the event of a new transfer. What it addresses itself to is, so with subdivision 1B, the following factors must be considered in determining whether a transfer is appropriate. And when there is a revocation and then an assertion that that revocation was incorrect, the result of that, if for instance, Mr. Ashman had convinced the CAP that his revocation was incorrect, the result of that would similarly be a transfer to CPS. So these are the factors that govern any transfer to CPS, any move from inside the razor wire to CPS.
Going back to the first part of your answer about the textual basis, I mean, 3E uses the word review. The SRB shall review the circumstances leading to the revocation. I mean, doesn't the concept of review, even if it doesn't say review according to the factors in 3A, doesn't that, just the nature of review, it seems to me, is that it would consider whether the executive director made a correct decision based upon the factors binding the executive director.
The commissioner's view is that that's not what review means in this particular context. And the reason for that is essentially what you say, which is that the legislature was perfectly able to say, or to explicitly limit the SRB or the CAP to say, review whether or not the executive director's decision under the factors in subdivision 3A was correct. There's no reason the legislature couldn't have written that. Instead, what this says is that the special review board will review the circumstances. So the facts surrounding the revocation are going to be part of its review when it applies the factors in subdivision 1B. And I'll suggest beyond textually a reason why that makes sense as a practical and sort of non-absurdity perspective. What Mr. Ashman is asking the court to do in holding that there is some kind of different set of standards to be applied based on whether it's a revocation review as opposed to a new transfer, it, especially in light of Mr. Ashman's suggestion that, which is correct, by the way, that someone can review or can request revocation review and new transfer at the same time. The way that would play out is that it would put the cap in this bizarre situation where they hear all of the evidence that it really is current at the time of the hearing. They hear about what happened with the revocation. They hear about what happened before the revocation in terms of the person's progress at CPS. They hear about what's happened after that since the person was returned inside the secure perimeter. And then what the cap would be asked to do is say, well, on the one hand, what we're going to do is consider everything that we've just heard up until the present time. And we're going to review all of those things under subdivision 1B and decide whether a new transfer is appropriate. But then on the other hand, if we think a new transfer isn't appropriate, because let's suppose this person has done something horrible since their return inside the secure perimeter, we're going to pretend that we don't know all that stuff. And now we're going to think about just whether the executive director's decision to revoke was correct. And let's just suppose that the decision to revoke the SRB or CAP decides was not correct. Then that, under Mr. Ashman's conception of the statute, that would require the CAP to, as a matter of fact, order a new transfer when they in fact affirmatively believe that the person does not meet the subdivision 1B criteria, but have decided that there was some kind of factual problem or some other problem with the revocation decision. And that just doesn't make any sense, especially in light of the present tense nature of the subdivision 1B factors. There's been some analogizing to, in Mr. Ashman's brief, to parole, for instance. Look, if somebody comes back, is out on parole, and let's just suppose that they are accused of stealing something and it's later determined that that was just a case of mistaken identity, completely wrong. But in the interim, upon being returned to DOC, they assaulted and murdered someone. No one suggests that there's a requirement that that person then be returned to parole or that the decision maker has to ignore what has happened in the interim. So it just doesn't make sense, and it's not there as a textual matter to suppose that there is some kind of alternate standards that apply to a revocation review request as opposed to a new transfer request. And for that reason, again, the commissioner is okay with it if, or would not oppose it if the court is inclined to reconsider the part of Doherty that strips from the CAP authority to review revocation decisions. But I just want to be very clear. We're talking about the transfer statute today. Maybe there would be different arguments with the PD statute, but for the purpose of the transfer statute, what the CAP would actually do in either one of those tracks is exactly the same thing. And the reason why there's no reason for remand here is because what the CAP actually did is exactly the same thing that it would have done, which is they heard evidence. Mr. Ashman wasn't prevented from putting on any evidence, and they made a decision under the factors in subdivision 1, paragraph B, after having heard what happened with his revocation and a number of other things.
Mr. Winter, are you aware of any other appeals in the pipeline from the CAP to this court that are similar to this? In other words, considering cases in which the CAP considered petitions such as this one and relied on Doherty?
I am not aware of any. I'm not certain that I would be. I think there's a chance I would be, but I apologize. I can't be more concrete than that.
Yeah.
For my final minute, if it's okay, I would just like to briefly address the procedural due process issue. There's a lot of briefing and case law on the issue of whether there is a liberty interest created by CPS transfer or revoked, or rather taken away by a revocation. I think, again, for the purpose of clarity and for the purpose of addressing these issues and resolving them in the simplest possible way, what the only point that I want to make there is Mr. Ashman has not identified any process, in other words, any opportunity to be heard that he did not receive in this case that he should have received. And again, that dovetails with the point that I already made regarding the identical nature of the CAPS review under new transfer or revocation. Point is, they heard all of his evidence. He wasn't barred from putting anything on about the revocation or anything else. They made a decision under the applicable factors, and Mr. Ashman has not appealed that decision. So we would ask the court to not remand and simply hold that it was a harmless error, if any, based on Doherty. If there's no further questions, that's all I have.
Either judge, any other questions? Very well. Thank you, Mr. Winter. And Ms. Avery, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal. You may proceed. You are muted. You'll have to unmute yourself.
Thank you. I just want to point out that the decision is entirely different between a new transfer or a new provisional discharge and a revocation. On a revocation, the SRB and the panel, they both look at the circumstances of the revocation and whether that revocation should be upheld. And the evidence in those cases is entirely different. When they do a new transfer or a new provisional discharge, there's a full set of reports. There's a sexual violence risk assessment. There's a special review board treatment report that goes through their whole history, and they make all kinds of determinations whether a new transfer is appropriate or whether the person should be on provisional discharge anew. They do not look at the revocation circumstances of the revocation. For example, in Mr. Ashman's case, one of the issues was a broken GPS. He never had a chance to present his evidence. The hearing on the new transfer is very short. I would have to advise clients to never put two petitions in together because they're going to be combined and heard in one hearing. There's a limited time to present evidence. And the evidence that was presented at the hearing wasn't sufficient time to talk about the circumstances relative to the revocation.
So Ms. Avery, in this case, did the circumstances that led to the revocation, did they get incorporated into the risk assessment and other materials that were submitted for purposes of a retransfer?
Not to my knowledge. I think they.
And can you be specific? Can you pinpoint what were the? How would you describe the circumstances that led to the revocation? What would you pinpoint?
For example, the one I've been talking about is the broken GPS. So he had, he laid in bed and his friend came to get him for dinner. He was attached to the outlet and he stood up. He immediately brought the broken GPS to the front security guard and reported it, and they got him a new one. So that is one of the reasons he was revoked, is because he was trying to escape and had a broken GPS. That was evidence that he was trying to escape. There were other factors as well, but that's just one that kind of demonstrates the difference between looking at the circumstances of the revocation, what really happened. Here's, we have an affidavit from the witness that was there, the security guard that he reported it to. That's the type of evidence that you're hearing, not whether a new transfer is appropriate. Speaking about the due process considerations, Mr. Ashman did have a protected liberty interest. This is a court-ordered process that he goes through for many years. It's important. It's a reduction in custody. It leads to his discharge. It's something that's very important. There is statutorily defined due process considerations, which is giving him notice within a short period of time of being moved to CPS. That never happened. Having a notice that said the specific facts and the specific details surrounding the revocation, that never happened. He had a vague a report that said there's treatment concerns and there's security concerns. Not once did they identify the exact nature, the specific facts, which is required by the statutes. They didn't give him notice in time. It was, I think it's 10 days or 14 days, and he got it 56 days later, for example. So none of the procedural requirements were followed. And that is necessary. He needs to have notice. And like the Wisconsin case that we mentioned, that Van I can't remember the exact name. He had the same situation. They did not give him notice of a violation of his sexual violence release. And so he didn't have a time to prepare. And that's one of the underpinnings of constitutionality, is that the person has proper notice and a meaningful way to present. At the SRB, they don't have a chance to bring witnesses. It's a half hour that covered both the new transfer and the revocation. He only had a few minutes to talk. They didn't represent any of the witnesses, any of the evidence. There's just not time in that. And so it wasn't a meaningful way to even have it reviewed by the SRB. You have to keep in mind that this was a court order to CPS by a panel of three judges. And the MSOP executive director, who doesn't even know the man, doesn't know the circumstances, just told by his staff, was able to revoke him based on hearsay information. And so for due process reasons, they do need to follow the statutory requirements of giving specific notice with specific facts so that he has time to prepare. Thank you very much.
Ms. Avery, did you represent him at the CAP?
I did not.
Did he have a chance to introduce evidence, the evidence that he wasn't allowed to produce at the SRB? Did he have a chance to introduce that to the CAP panel, and did he do so?
He attempted to. He had an affidavit from his peer that he wasn't able to leave St. Peter and testify, so he wasn't there in person. But it was rejected because it was hearsay. So he did not have a meaningful way to put forth his information.
He himself testified, I take it?
He did.
Yeah.
But they focused really on the new transfer because the panel was clear from the beginning that that's really where the focus was for them. And there's not enough time to do both of these things. They need to set up separate hearings for both or separate times so that each one can be addressed separately and not combined, because it just gets too muddled and they lose focus. And in this case, they didn't even consider it. So that's why we're asking for them to remand for a new hearing so that he has time to present the information. And so really that they can give us the specific facts of why he was revoked in the first place. Thank you.
Very well, thank you to all counsel. We appreciate your information and Ms. Lasky for being available as well, though you may not have planned on it. We will take the matter under advisement, issue a ruling in the statutory timeline, and you all enjoy a St. Patrick's Day.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, everybody.